Dr. Jorgensen's account was the first I had received of the effects of sudden deafness on one side, but since he wrote to me, I have found that his experience is far from unusual. One friend of mine, Howard Branston, related to me how, 20 years ago, he had an attack of sudden vertigo, followed by an almost complete loss of hearing in his right ear. I could still hear sounds on that side, he said, but could not unscramble words or distinguish tonal differences. He continued, "The following week I had concert tickets, but the musical performance sounded flat, lifeless, and without the harmonious quality I loved. Yes, I could recognize the music, but instead of the uplifting emotional experience I was anticipating, I became so depressed that tears came to my eyes." There were other problems, too. Howard was an avid hunter, and on his first deer hunting trip after his hearing loss, he found that his ability to locate sounds was severely undermined. "Standing absolutely still, I could hear the scurry of the chipmunk, the foraging of the squirrel, but the ability I formerly had to pinpoint the location of these sounds was now lost to me. I began to realize that if I wished to be a successful hunter, I would have to learn to compensate for the sensory handicap." After several months, Howard discovered many ways to compensate for his hearing loss on one side. He would alternate between analyzing a scene visually and auditorily, trying to meld the two perceptual inputs. "After a while," he said, "I no longer had to close my eyes if I kept scanning the scene by moving my head in a side-to-side motion, with a very slight up-and-down wave motion. After quite a while, I began to feel comfortable enough to go dangerous game hunting again. Now I was searching for sounds that were familiar to me." Composer, ethnomusicologist, and virtual reality pioneer Jaron Lanier is concerned with designing virtual reality with the greatest possible visual and auditory fidelity. He stresses that micro-movements of the head, movements of a few millimeters or tiny rotations, performed automatically and unconsciously in fractions of a second, occur even in those with perfect binaural hearing, and are indeed necessary for precise sound location. The scanning head movements that Branston describes, and which most of those who lose an eye or an ear develop, seem to be, at least in part, an amplification of these normally tiny micro-movements of the head. In a concert hall, Howard learned to turn his head slightly, as if I was looking at the instruments that would be playing at that moment, to the left for the violins, and slightly to the right for the bass and percussion. The sense of touch, as well as that of sight, was crucial in helping him reconstruct a sense of musical space. He experimented with his stereo subwoofer, which, he said, made me most aware of the tactile, physical nature of the sounds I was listening to. In his trophy room, which he had designed to be a perfect listening environment for his high-end stereo, he would use the power of the subwoofer to help him round up memories and images of sound and space. Perhaps all of us, unconsciously, use visual and tactile cues along with auditory ones to create the fullness of musical perception. With these, and doubtless many other accommodations, both conscious and unconscious, Howard now gets a pseudo-stereo effect, as Dr. Jorgensen does, and he enjoys music once again. Chapter 12. 2,000 Operas. Musical Savants. The first adult musical savant I met was a retarded man who had been admitted to a nursing home where I worked. I first described Martin in A Walking Grove, a chapter in The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Martin had been normal at birth, but at the age of 3 he contracted meningitis, which caused seizures and a spastic weakness of his limbs and voice. It also affected his intelligence and personality, so that he became impulsive, odd, and unable to keep up with his classmates at school. But along with these problems, he developed curious powers. He became fascinated by music, would listen to it intently, and would then sing the melodies he had heard or play them on the piano, as best he could with his spastic limbs and voice. He was greatly encouraged in this by his father, who was a professional opera singer. Along with his musical abilities, Martin also developed a prodigious rote memory. Once he was fitted with glasses for the very severe visual problems he had been born with, he became an avid reader, retaining, though often not understanding, everything he read. And this, like his musical memory, was auditory. Whatever he read, he heard in his mind's ear, sometimes in his father's voice. As some people may be said to have a photographic memory, Martin had a phonographic one. Though solitary in his habits, Martin was able to live independently and to do simple, unskilled work. His only pleasure, seemingly, was to sing in church choirs. He could not be a solo singer with his hoarse, spastic voice, but by the time he was 61, his increasing physical disabilities, arthritis and heart disease among them, brought him to the nursing home. When I met him in 1984, he told me that he knew more than 2,000 operas, as well as The Messiah, The Christmas Oratorio, and all of Bach's cantatas. I brought along scores of some of these, and tested him as best I could. I found I was unable to fault him. And it was not just the melodies that he remembered. He had learned, from listening to performances, what every instrument played, what every voice sang. When I played him a piece by Debussy that he had never heard, he was able to repeat it almost flawlessly on the piano. He then transposed it into different keys and extemporized on it a little, in a Debussyan way. He could grasp the rules and the conventions of any music he heard, even if it was unfamiliar or not to his taste. This was musicianship of a high order in a man who was otherwise so mentally impoverished. What was the origin of Martin's musical powers? He had an intensely musical father, and musical ability is often inherited, as with the 7 generations of the Bach family. He was born into and grew up in a musical household. Was this enough? Or did his auditory and potentially musical powers also gain strength from the poorness of his vision? Darold Treffort, in his remarkable book on savantism, Extraordinary People, notes that more than a third of all musical savants are blind or have very poor vision. Martin was born with very severe visual problems, but this was not recognized and corrected until he was almost 3. So in these early years, he must have been nearly blind and dependent on hearing to orient him and make sense of the world. Or was it the meningitis, which, while stripping him of some of his cortical controls and higher powers, also stimulated or released previously unsuspected savant powers? The term idiot savant was introduced in 1887 by Langdon Down, a London physician, in reference to feeble-minded children who had special and sometimes remarkable faculties. Among these were exceptional powers of calculation, drawing, mechanical aptitude, and above all, of remembering, playing, and sometimes composing music. The case of Blind Tom, an American slave who exhibited prodigious musical powers from an early age, attracted worldwide attention in the 1860s. The pianist John Davis recorded much of Blind Tom's music on a 1999 CD. Davis has subsequently written about the savant slave's fascinating history in several articles and is currently working on a book about Blind Tom and his times. Musicality is indeed the most common and perhaps the most dramatic form of savant talent, for it readily comes to public notice and commands attention. Darold Treffort devoted a large part of Extraordinary People to musical savants, and Leon K. Miller wrote an entire book about a single musical savant, Eddie. Detailed studies of savant talents, and especially of musical savant skills, have been carried out by Beata Hermelin and others in London, and these confirm that such skills depend on the recognition, which may be implicit and unconscious, of essential musical structures and rules, as is the case with normal musical skills. The anomaly is not in the skill itself, but in its isolation. Its unusual and sometimes prodigious development in a mind that may otherwise be markedly underdeveloped in verbal and abstract thought. Stephen Wiltshire, an autistic English prodigy, is widely known as a visual savant. He can produce amazingly detailed drawings of complex buildings and even whole cityscapes, sometimes after a single glance. I have described Stephen's visual and musical powers at length in An Anthropologist on Mars, in the chapter called Prodigies. He is able to hold these images in his mind with little loss or distortion for years on end. When he went to school at the age of 6, his teacher commented that his drawings were the most unchildlike drawings I have ever seen. Stephen is also a musical savant. Savant abilities usually appear before the age of 10, and this is especially so of musical savant talents. Yet when Stephen's mentor, Margaret Hewson, phoned me to say, "Stephen has erupted musical powers, huge powers," he was already 16. Like Martin, Stephen had absolute pitch and could instantly reproduce complex chords, play melodies he had never heard before, even if they were several minutes long, and transpose them easily into different keys. He also showed powers of improvisation. It is unclear why Stephen's musical gifts seem to appear relatively late. It seems likely that he had great musical potential from an early age, but perhaps due to his own passivity and the focus of others on his visual gifts, this was not noticed. Perhaps, too, adolescence had an effect, as Stephen suddenly became fixated on Stevie Wonder and Tom Jones at this point, and loved to mimic their movements and mannerisms along with their music. It is a characteristic, indeed, the defining characteristic of savant syndromes, that there is a heightening of certain powers along with an impairment or poor development of other powers. The powers that are heightened in savant skills are always of a concrete sort, whereas those that are impaired are abstract and often linguistic, and there have been many speculations as to how such a conjunction of strength and weakness may come about. It has been known for a century and a half that there is a relative but not absolute specialization in the functions of the two sides of the brain, with the development of abstract and verbal powers being especially associated with the left or dominant cerebral hemisphere, and perceptual skills with the right. This hemispheric asymmetry is very pronounced in humans and present in a lesser degree in primates and some other mammals, and is observable even in utero. In the fetus, and perhaps the very young child, the situation is reversed, for the right hemisphere develops earlier and more quickly than the left, allowing perceptual functions to be established in the first days and weeks of life. The left hemisphere takes longer to develop, but continues to change in fundamental ways after birth. And as it develops and acquires its own largely conceptual and linguistic powers, it starts to suppress or inhibit some of the perceptual functions of the right hemisphere. The functional and perhaps immunological immaturity of the left hemisphere in utero and during infancy makes it unusually susceptible to damage. And if such damage occurs, so Geschwind and Galaberda have hypothesized, there may be a compensatory overdevelopment of the right hemisphere, an actual enlargement made possible by neuronal migration. This may reverse the normal course of events and produce an anomalous right hemisphere dominance instead of the usual left hemisphere dominance. Shifts to right hemisphere dominance can also occur after birth, at least in the first 5 years of life, if the left hemisphere is damaged. Geschwind's interest in this phenomenon was ignited in part by the remarkable fact that a left hemispherectomy, a drastic procedure sometimes performed for intractable epilepsy, in which the entire left hemisphere is removed, does not render a young child permanently languageless, but is followed by the development of language functions in the right hemisphere. It seems quite possible that something like this happened with the 3-year-old Martin following his meningitis. Such hemispheric shifts may also occur, though to a lesser degree, in adults who have predominantly left-sided damage to the brain. Savant-like talents may sometimes emerge in later life. There are several anecdotal descriptions of such an emergence following brain injuries, strokes, tumors, and frontotemporal dementia, especially if the damage is confined initially to the left temporal lobe. Clive Waring, described in Chapter 15, had a herpes encephalitis infection affecting especially his left frontal and temporal regions, and, in addition to his devastating amnesia, developed a savant-like speed of calculation and punning. The rapidity with which savant talents may emerge in such circumstances suggests a disinhibition or release of right hemisphere functions from an inhibition or suppression normally exerted by the left temporal lobe. In 1999, Alan Snyder and D.J. Mitchell inverted the usual question of why savant talents are so rare and asked instead, why don't we all have savant talents? They suggested that the mechanism for such skills might reside in all of us in early life, but as the brain matures, they are inhibited, at least from conscious awareness. They theorized that savants might have privileged access to lower levels of information not available through introspection. Subsequently, they started to test this theory experimentally using transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS, which now allows a brief and virtually instantaneous way of inhibiting physiological functions in different parts of the brain. Using normal volunteers, they applied TMS to the left temporal lobe for a few minutes in a stimulation designed to inhibit the abstract and conceptual thought governed by this area of the brain, and, they hoped, to allow a transient release of perceptual functions in the right hemisphere. These experiments have produced modest but suggestive results, seemingly improving skills like drawing, calculating, and proofreading for a few minutes. Bossemeyer and Snyder are also investigating whether absolute pitch can be released by TMS. Similar techniques have been used by Robin Young and her colleagues, who found in one study that they could duplicate the release effect, but only in 5 out of 17 subjects. They concluded that these mechanisms are not available to everyone, and individuals may differ in either their ability to access these mechanisms or even whether they possess such a mechanism. Whether or not this is the case, it certainly seems that a sizable minority, perhaps 30%, of normal adults may have latent or suppressed savant potentials, which may be released to some degree by techniques such as TMS. This is not entirely surprising, given that various pathological conditions, frontotemporal dementia, dominant hemisphere strokes, certain head injuries and infections, may lead on occasion to the appearance of savant-like abilities. One must infer that there are, in many individuals at least, very concrete eidetic and mnemonic powers, which are normally hidden, but which may surface or be released under exceptional conditions. The existence of such potentials is only intelligible in evolutionary and developmental terms, as early forms of perception and cognition, which once had adaptive value but are now suppressed and superseded by other forms. Darold Treffert, who has studied dozens of people with savant powers, both congenital and acquired, emphasizes that there are no instant savants, no easy path to savantism. Special mechanisms, whether they are universal or not, may be necessary but not sufficient for savantism. All savants spend years developing and honing their skills, sometimes obsessively, and sometimes drawn on by the pleasure of exercising a special skill, a pleasure perhaps heightened by its contrast with their own overall intellectual impairments, or by the recognition and rewards their powers may bring. Being a savant is a way of life, a whole organization of personality, even though it may be built on a single mechanism or skill. Chapter 13. An Auditory World, music and blindness. When I was growing up in London in the 1930s, I especially enjoyed the visits of Enrico, the piano tuner, who would come every few months to tune our pianos. We had an upright and a grand, and since everyone in the family played, they were always getting out of tune. Once, when Enrico was ill, a substitute tuner came, a tuner who, to my amazement, got around without a white stick and could apparently see normally. Up to that point, I had assumed that, like Enrico, all piano tuners were blind. I thought of this years later in regard to my friend Jerome Bruner, for in addition to his many other gifts, he is immensely sensitive to music and possesses extraordinary powers of musical memory and imagery. When I asked him about these, he said that he did not come from a musical family, but that he was born with congenital cataracts, not operated on until he was 2. He was functionally blind in his first 2 years, seeing only light and shadow, and some movement before his cataracts were removed, and this, he thought, forced him to focus on sounds of all sorts, especially voices and music. This special sensitivity to the auditory has stayed with him all his life. It was similar with Martin, my musical savant patient, who wore thick pebble glasses like Jerry Bruner. Martin had been born with very severe farsightedness, more than 20 diopters, which was not diagnosed and corrected until he was almost 3. He, too, must have been functionally blind as an infant before he had glasses. Did this play a part in making him a musical savant? The image of the blind musician or the blind poet has an almost mythic resonance, as if the gods have given the gifts of music or poetry in compensation for the sense they have taken away. Blind musicians and bards have played a special role in many cultures, as wandering minstrels, court performers, religious cantors. For centuries, there was a tradition of blind church organists in Europe. There are many blind musicians, especially, though not exclusively, in the world of gospel, blues, and jazz. Stevie Wonder, Ray Charles, Art Tatum, Jose Feliciano, Rassan Roland Kirk, and Doc Watson are only a few. Many such artists, indeed, have blind added to their names, almost as an honorific. Blind Lemon Jefferson, the Blind Boys of Alabama, Blind Willie McTell, Blind Willie Johnson. The channeling of blind people into musical performance is partly a social phenomenon, since the blind were perceived as being cut off from many other occupations. But social forces here are matched by strong internal forces. Blind children are often precociously verbal and develop unusual verbal memories. Many of them are similarly drawn to music and motivated to make it central to their lives. Children who lack a visual world will naturally discover or create a rich world of touch and sound. At least there are many anecdotes to suggest this, but Adam Ockleford has moved beyond these casual observations to systematic studies in the last 20 years or so. Ockleford has worked as a music teacher at a school for the blind and is now Director of Education at the Royal National Institute of the Blind in London. He has been especially concerned with a rare congenital condition, septo-optic dysplasia, which leads to visual impairment, sometimes relatively mild but often profound. Working with Linda Pring, Graham Welsh and Daryl Trefford, he compared 32 families of children with this condition to an equal number of control families. Half of the children with SOD had no vision or could perceive only light or movement. They were ranked as blind. The other half were partially sighted. Ockleford et al. Noted that there was far more interest in music among the blind and the partially sighted than among the fully sighted. One mother, speaking of her 7-year-old blind daughter, said, "Her music is always with her. If there is not music playing, she is singing. She listens to music while in the car, while falling asleep, and loves to play the piano and any other instrument." Though the partially sighted children also showed a heightened interest in music, exceptional musical abilities were observed only in the blind children, abilities that surfaced spontaneously without any formal teaching. Thus, it was not SOD as such, but the degree of blindness, the fact of not having a significant visual world, that played a key role in stimulating the musical propensities and abilities of the blind children. In various other studies, Oakleford found that 40% to 60% of the blind children he taught had absolute pitch, and a recent study by Hamilton, Pasquale Leone, and Schlaug also found that 60% of blind musicians had absolute pitch, as opposed to perhaps 10% among sighted musicians. In normally sighted musicians, early musical training before the age of 6 or 8 is crucial in the development or maintenance of absolute pitch. But in these blind musicians, absolute pitch was common even when musical training had been started relatively late, sometimes as late as adolescence. A third or more of the human cortex is concerned with vision, and if visual input is suddenly lost, very extensive reorganizations and remappings may occur in the cerebral cortex, with the development, sometimes, of intermodal sensations of all sorts. There is much evidence from Pasquale Leone and his colleagues, as well as others, to show that in those born blind or early blinded, the massive visual cortex, far from remaining functionless, is reallocated to other sensory inputs, especially hearing and touch, and becomes specialized for the processing of these. Even when blindness begins later in life, such reallocation can occur. Nadine Gabb et al., in their study of one late blinded musician with absolute pitch, were able to show extensive activation of both visual association areas while he listened to music. Frédéric Gougou, Robert Sartori, and others in Montreal have shown that blind people are better than sighted controls at judging the direction of pitch change between sounds, even when the speed of change is 10 times faster than that perceived by controls, but only if they became blind at an early age. A 10-fold difference here is extraordinary. One does not usually encounter a whole order of magnitude difference in a basic perceptual capacity. The exact neural correlates underlying musical skills in the blind have not yet been fully defined, but are being intensively studied in Montreal and elsewhere. In the meantime, we have only the iconic image of the blind musician, the large numbers of blind musicians in the world, descriptions of the frequent musicality of blind children, and personal memoirs. One of the most beautiful of these is the autobiography of Jacques Lusserin, a writer and hero of the French Resistance, who was gifted musically and played the cello as a boy, even before being blinded at the age of 7. In his memoir, And There Was Light, he emphasized the immense importance of music for him after he lost his sight. The first concert hall I ever entered, when I was 8 years old, meant more to me in the space of a minute than all the fabled kingdoms. Going into the hall was the first step in a love story. The tuning of the instruments was my engagement. I wept with gratitude every time the orchestra began to sing. A world of sounds for a blind man. What sudden grace! For a blind person, music is nourishment. He needs to receive it, to have it administered at intervals, like food. Music was made for blind people. Chapter 14. The Key of Clear Green. Synesthesia and music. For centuries, humans have searched for a relationship between music and color. Newton thought that the spectrum had 7 discrete colors, corresponding in some unknown but simple way to the 7 notes of the diatonic scale. Color organs, and similar instruments, in which each note would be accompanied by a specific color, go back to the early 18th century. And there are no less than 18 densely packed columns on color and music in the Oxford Companion to Music. For most of us, the association of color and music is at the level of metaphor. Like and as if are the hallmarks of such metaphors. But for some people, One sensory experience may instantly and automatically provoke another. For a true synesthete, there is no as if, simply an instant conjoining of sensations. This may involve any of the senses. For example, one person may perceive individual letters or days of the week as having their own particular colours. Another may feel that every colour has its own peculiar smell, or every musical interval its own taste. One of the first systematic accounts of synesthesia, as this was dubbed in the 1890s, was provided by Francis Galton in his classic 1883 Inquiries into Human Faculty and Its Development, an eccentric and wide-ranging book which included his discovery of the individuality of fingerprints, his use of composite photography, and, most notoriously, his thoughts on eugenics. Galton's studies of mental imagery started with an inquiry into people's abilities to visualize scenes, faces, and so on in vivid, veridical detail, and then proceeded to their imagery of numbers. Some of Galton's subjects, to his astonishment, said they invariably saw particular numerals, whether they were actually looking at them or even imagining them, in a particular colour, always the same colour. Though Galton at first thought of this as no more than an association, he soon became convinced that it was a physiological phenomenon, a specific and innate faculty of mind, with some kinship to mental imagery but more fixed, more stereotyped and automatic in nature, and, in contrast to other forms of mental imagery, virtually impossible to influence by consciousness or will. Until recently, I had rarely had occasion, as a neurologist, to see anyone with synesthesia, for synesthesia is not something that brings patients to neurologists. Some estimate the incidence of synesthesia to be about 1 in 2,000, but it may be considerably more common, since most people who have it do not consider it to be a condition. They have always been this way, and they assume, until they learn to the contrary, that what they experience is perfectly normal and usual, that everyone experiences fusions of different senses as they do. Thus, I have recently discovered, simply by asking, that several patients whom I have been seeing for other conditions, sometimes for years, are in fact synesthetes as well. They had simply never thought to mention it, and I had never asked. For many years, the only patient I knew to be a synesthete was a painter who suddenly became totally colorblind following a head injury. I described this case, the case of the colorblind painter, in An Anthropologist on Mars. He lost not only the ability to perceive or even imagine color, but also the automatic seeing of color with music, which he had had all his life. Though this was, in a sense, the least of his losses, it was nevertheless a significant one, for music had always been enriched, as he put it, by the colours that accompanied it. This persuaded me that synesthesia was a physiological phenomenon, dependent on the integrity of certain areas of the cortex and the connections between them. In his case, between specific areas in the visual cortex needed to construct the perception or imagery of colour. The destruction of these areas in this man had left him unable to experience any colour, including coloured music. Of all the different forms of synesthesia, musical synesthesia, especially colour effects experienced while listening to or thinking of music, is one of the most common and perhaps the most dramatic. We do not know if it is more common in musicians or musical people, but musicians are, of course, more likely to be aware of it, and many of the people who have recently described their musical synesthesias to me have been musicians. The eminent contemporary composer Michael Torkey has been deeply influenced by experiences with coloured music. Torkey showed striking musical gifts at an early age, and when he was 5 he was given a piano and a piano teacher. "I was already a composer at 5," he says. His teacher would divide pieces into sections, and Michael would rearrange the sections in different orders as he played. One day he remarked to his teacher, "I love that blue piece." His teacher was not sure she had heard correctly. "Blue?" "Yes," said Michael. The piece in D major. D major is blue. Not for me, the teacher replied. She was puzzled, and Michael too, for he assumed that everyone saw colours associated with musical keys. When he began to realise that not everyone shared this synesthesia, he had difficulty imagining what that would be like. He thought it would amount to a sort of blindness. Michael has had this kind of key synesthesia, seeing fixed colours associated with the playing of music, scales, arpeggios, anything with a key signature, as far back as he can remember. He has always had absolute pitch, too, as far as he knows. This in itself makes musical keys absolutely distinctive for him. G sharp minor, for example, has a different flavour from G minor, he says, in the same way that major and minor keys have different qualities for the rest of us. Indeed, he says, he cannot imagine having key synesthesia without having absolute pitch. Each key, each mode for him, looks as distinctive and as characteristic as it sounds. The colours have been constant and fixed since his earliest years, and they appear spontaneously. No effort of will or imagination can change them. They seem completely natural to him and preordained. The colours are highly specific. G minor, for example, is not just yellow, but ochre or gamboge. D minor is like flint, graphite. F minor is earthy, ashy. He struggles to find the right word, as he would struggle to find the right paint or crayon. The colours of major and minor keys are always related. For instance, G minor is a subdued yellow ochre, G major, bright yellow. But otherwise, he is hard put to find any system or rule by which the colours of particular keys might be predicted. At one time, he wondered whether the colours had been suggested by actual associations when he was very young. A toy piano, perhaps, with each key a different colour. But he has no clear memories of any such thing. He feels, in any case, that there are far too many colour associations, 14 for the major and minor keys, another half dozen for the modes as a start, to make such an explanation likely. Moreover, some keys seem to have strange hues which he can hardly describe, and which he has almost never seen in the world about him. When I asked Michael in what sense he saw his colours, he spoke of their luminosity. The colours had a sort of transparent, luminous brilliance, he said, like a screen before him, but they in no way occluded or altered his normal vision. What would happen, I asked, if he saw a D major blue while looking at a yellow wall? Would he see green? No, he replied. His synesthetic colours were wholly inward and never confused with external colours. Yet subjectively, they were very intense and real. The colours he sees with musical keys have been absolutely fixed and consistent for 40 years or more, and he wonders whether they were present at birth or determined when he was a newborn. Others have tested the accuracy and consistency of his colour key associations over time, and they have not changed. He sees no colours associated with isolated notes or different pitches, nor will he see colour if, say, a fifth is played, for a fifth, as such, is ambiguous, not associated with a particular key. There needs to be a major or minor triad, or a succession of notes sufficient to indicate the basic key signature. Everything goes back to the tonic, he says. Context, however, is also important. Thus, Brahms's Second Symphony is in D major, blue, but one movement is in G minor, ochre. This movement will still be blue if played in the context of the whole symphony, but it may be ochre if he reads, plays, or imagines it separately. He particularly liked Mozart and Vivaldi as a boy, above all for their use of keys, which, he says, was pure, narrow. They used a simpler palette. Later, in adolescence, he became enamoured of Chopin, Schumann, the Romantic composers, though with their convoluted modulations, they made special demands on his synesthesia. Michael does not have any colour associations with musical pattern or texture, rhythm, instruments, composers, mood or emotion, only with key. He does, however, have other sorts of non-musical synesthesia. For him, letters, numbers and days of the week all have their own particular colours and a peculiar topography or landscape as well. I asked Michael what role, if any, his musical synesthesia played in his creative life, whether it took his thinking and imagination in unexpected directions. Certain classical composers, including Scriabin, Messiaen, and Rimsky-Korsakov, made explicit use of their own synesthesia in their compositions. There was an explicit connection, he answered, between colour and key in the first orchestral music he wrote, a series of five pieces called Colour Music, in which each piece explored the musical possibilities of a single key, and thus a single colour. The first of these pieces was entitled Ecstatic Orange. The others were Bright Blue Music, Green, Purple, and Ash. But apart from these early pieces, Michael has never again made explicit use of his key synesthesia in his work, a remarkable and ever-expanding range of music, which now includes operas, ballets, and symphonic pieces. He is frequently asked whether synesthesia has made much difference to his life, especially as a professional musician. He says, "For me at least, it's no big deal. For him, it is normal and completely unremarkable." David Caldwell, another composer, also has musical synesthesia, but of a distinctly different sort. When I mentioned Michael's equation of yellow with G major to him, he exclaimed, "That seems wrong to me." So too was Michael's green for E major, and indeed most of Michael's colours, although David said he could see the logic of some of them. Every synesthete has his own colour correspondences. Colour key association goes both ways for David. Seeing a piece of transparent golden yellow glass on my windowsill put him in mind of B flat major. "Something clear and golden about that key," he said. Was it, he wondered, the colour of brass? Trumpets, he said, are B flat instruments, and a lot of brass music is written in this key. He is not sure what determines his particular colours. Have they arisen from experience, by conventional association? Are they arbitrary? Have they any meaning? While David does not have perfect pitch, he has excellent relative pitch. He remembers accurately the pitch of many songs and many instruments, and can immediately infer from this what key any piece is played in. Each key, he says, has its own quality, and each key also has its own individual colour. David feels that the colour of music is central to his musical sensibility and musical thought, for it is not just keys that have distinctive colours. Musical themes, patterns, ideas, and moods have colours too, as do particular instruments and parts for them. Synesthetic colours accompany every stage of his musical thinking. His groping for the underlying structure of things is facilitated by colour, and he knows he is on course, that he is achieving his goal, when the synesthetic colours seem right. Colour flavours and enriches, and above all, clarifies his musical thinking. But it is difficult to pin down or systematise his correspondences. When I asked him to make a chart of his synesthetic colours, he thought for a few days and then wrote to me, "The more I've tried to fill in the blanks on my chart, the more tenuous the connections have seemed. Michael's connections are so fixed and don't seem to involve intellectual or emotional consideration. Mine, on the other hand, have a lot to do with how I feel about keys and how I use them in composing and playing music." Gian Bielli, Michaela Eslin and Lutz Janka, researchers in Zurich, have described a professional musician with both music colour and music taste synesthesia. Whenever she hears a specific musical interval, she automatically experiences a taste on her tongue that is consistently linked to that musical interval. In a 2005 article in Nature, they detailed her associations. Minor second, sour. Major second, bitter. Minor third, salty. Major third, sweet. Fourth, mown grass. Tritone, disgust. Fifth, pure water. Minor sixth, cream. Major sixth, low-fat cream. Minor seventh, bitter. Major seventh, sour. Octave, no taste. Any auditory uncertainty as to what musical interval she is hearing is immediately compensated for by its taste, for her musical synesthetic tastes are instantaneous, automatic, and always correct. I have also heard of violinists who make use of synesthesia to tune their instruments, and piano tuners who find it useful in their work. Christine Leahy, a writer, visual artist, and guitar player, has strong synesthesia for letters, numbers, and days of the week, as well as a strong, though less specific, color synesthesia for music. Her letter chromesthesia is especially strong, and if a word begins with a red letter, for example, its redness may spread to involve the whole word. Thus, when she looks at a page in a book, she is apt to see it as a polychromatic mosaic, the larger coloured pieces formed by words, the smaller ones by individual letters. This chromesthesia has no relation to the meaning of words or to her ability to understand them, but it does depend on the familiarity of letters. She saw a page of German as richly coloured, although this is a language she does not understand. But when I showed her a page of Korean, she saw no colours at all, until some of the Korean letters, in her mind, assumed a slight resemblance to English ones. Then isolated points of colour appeared on the page. Christine does not have absolute pitch, and cannot perceive any intrinsic difference between different keys. But the colour concomitants of letters also apply to the letters of the musical scale, so that if she knows that a particular note is D, it will elicit a sensation of greenness as vivid as that of the letter D. This synesthesia applies also to the sound of the note. She described the following colour sensations when tuning her guitar, bringing a string down from E, blue, to D, green. Rich, saturated blue, blue fading out, it seems grainier, a textured and unsaturated green, a smooth, pure, rich green. I asked about what happened visually with the semitone, the E-flat, between E and D, and she said, nothing, it's a blank. None of the sharps or flats have colour concomitants for her, though she perceives them and plays them without any difficulty. When she plays a diatonic scale, the scale of C major, she sees a rainbow of colours in spectral order, each colour dissolving into the next. But when she plays a chromatic scale, the colours are interrupted by a series of blanks. She ascribes this to the fact that when she was very young, she learned the alphabet by means of coloured letter magnets on the refrigerator. These were organised in groups of seven, A to G, H to N, etc., their colours corresponding to the seven colours of the rainbow. But there was nothing, of course, corresponding to sharps or flats in these letters. She regards her musical synesthesia as an enhancement or enrichment of music, even though it may have initially had a linguistic rather than a musical origin. She was aghast when I told her the story of the colourblind painter and how he had lost his musical synesthesia when he became colourblind. She would be stricken, she said, if she were to lose hers. It would be like losing a sense. Patrick Ellen is a psychologist and songwriter who has very extensive synesthesia, not only to music, but to sounds of all sorts, from musical instruments to car horns, voices, animal noises, thunder, so that the world of sound is continuously transformed into a flowing world of colours and shapes. He also has colour synesthesia to letters, numbers, and days of the week. He remembers how his first grade teacher, seeing him staring into space, asked what he was looking at. He replied that he was counting the colours till Friday. The whole class burst into laughter, and thereafter he kept such matters to himself. It was only when he was 18, in a chance conversation with a fellow student, that he heard the term synesthesia, and realized that what he had always had, and had always taken for granted, was in fact a condition. His curiosity aroused, he began reading about synesthesia, and thought about writing his dissertation on the subject. He feels that his synesthesia moved him to become a psychologist, though his professional work has been in other realms, speech, discourse, linguistics, and not in synesthesia. Some of his synesthetic correspondences are of mnemonic use to him. Thus, when someone said that 9/11 was a Monday, he could instantly, and with assurance, say that it was not, for Tuesday is yellow for him, and 9/11 is yellow too. But it is the musical synesthesia which plays a vital part in his sensibility and his creative life. Patrick does not experience, like Michael Torkey, a fixed relation between colour and key. This seems to be a relatively rare form of musical synesthesia, perhaps because it demands absolute pitch, too. Synesthesia, for Patrick, is evoked by virtually every other aspect of music, its rhythm and tempo, the shapes of melodies, their modulation into different keys, the richness of harmonies, the timbre of different instruments, and especially the overall character and mood of what he is hearing. Listening to music for Patrick is immensely enhanced, never occluded or distracted, by the rich stream of visual sensations that accompany it. But it is in composing, above all, that he values his synesthesia. Patrick has songs, fragments of songs, and ideas for songs continually running through his head, and his synesthesia is crucial for their realization, an integral part of the creative process. The very concept of music for him is infused with the visual. Color is not added to music, it is integral to it. He only wishes that others could share this totality, and he tries to suggest it, he says, as fully as he can in his own songs. Sue B., another synesthete, seems to experience musical synesthesia not so much with color as with light, shape, and position. She describes her experience this way. I always see images when I hear music, but I do not associate specific colors with particular musical keys or musical intervals. I wish that I could say that a minor third is always a blue-green color, but I do not distinguish the intervals all that well. My musical skills are pretty modest. When I hear music, I see little circles or vertical bars of light getting brighter, whiter, or more silvery for higher pitches and turning a lovely deep maroon for the lower pitches. A run up the scale will produce a succession of increasingly brighter spots or vertical bars moving upward, while a trill, like in a Mozart piano sonata, will produce a flicker. High, distinct notes on a violin evoke sharp, bright lines, while notes played with vibrato seem to shimmer. Several stringed instruments playing together evoke overlapping parallel bars, or, depending on the melody, spirals of light of different shades shimmering together. Sounds made by brass instruments produce a fan-like image. High notes are positioned slightly in front of my body, at head level, and toward the right, while bass notes are located deep in the center of my abdomen. A chord will envelop me. The history of scientific interest in synesthesia has gone through many vicissitudes. In the early 19th century, when Keats and Shelley and other poets used extravagant intersensory images and metaphors, it seemed that synesthesia was no more than a poetic or imaginative conceit. Then came a series of careful psychological studies in the 1860s and 1870s, culminating in Galton's Inquiries into Human Faculty and Its Development in 1883. These served to legitimate the phenomenon and were soon followed by the introduction of the word synesthesia. Towards the end of the 19th century, with Rimbaud and the symbolist poets, the notion of synesthesia again seemed a poetic conceit, and it ceased to be regarded as a subject for scientific investigation. This changed yet again in the last third of the 20th century, as John Harrison details in his excellent book, Synesthesia, The Strangest Thing. In the 1980s, Richard Cytowic made the first neurophysiological studies of synesthetic subjects, studies that, for all their technical limitations, seemed to show a genuine activation of different sensory areas in the brain, for example, auditory and visual, coincident with synesthetic experiences. In 1989, he published a pioneering text, Synesthesia, A Union of the Senses, and this was followed by a popular exploration of the subject in 1993, The Man Who Tasted Shapes. Current techniques of functional brain imaging now give unequivocal evidence for the simultaneous activation or co-activation of two or more sensory areas of the cerebral cortex in synesthetes, just as Cytowic's work had predicted. While Cytowic was investigating synesthesia in the United States, Simon Baron Cohen and John Harrison were opening up the subject in England, and in 1997 they published a review volume, Synesthesia, Classic and Contemporary Readings. Galton believed that genuine synesthesia was strongly familial, and Harrison and Baron Cohen noted that a third of their subjects reported close relatives who also had synesthesia. Nabokov, in his autobiography, Speak, Memory, wrote of how as a child he saw all the letters of the alphabet as having distinct colours, and was deeply upset when he was given a box of coloured letters and found that nearly all of them were the wrong colour. His mother, also a synesthete, agreed with him that the colours were wrong, but not on what they should be. Nabokov's wife, too, was a synesthete, as is their son. While synesthesia has been regarded as quite rare, affecting perhaps one person in 2,000, and to have a strong gender preference, with a female-to-male ratio of about 6-1, a recent study by Julia Simner, Jamie Ward, and their colleagues has brought both of these suppositions into question. Using a random population of almost 1,700 subjects and objective tests to separate genuine from pseudo-synesthesia, they found that one person in 23 had some kind of synesthesia, most commonly for coloured days, and that there was no significant gender difference. Prior to 1999, there were no objective psychological tests for synesthesia. But in the past few years, V.S. Ramachandran and E.M. Hubbard have brought great experimental ingenuity to the testing of this. In order to distinguish true synesthesia from pseudo-synesthesia, for example, they have devised tests that only a genuine synesthete can pass. One such test, described in their 2001 paper in the Journal of Consciousness Studies, presents the subject with a medley of rather similar-looking twos and fives, all printed in black. The ordinary person would be hard put to distinguish these at a glance, but a colour number synesthete can distinguish them easily by their different colours. Functional brain imaging has now confirmed that there is activation of visual areas, especially colour processing areas, in synesthetes when they see colours in response to speech or music. There is little room for doubt anymore as to the physiological as well as the psychological reality of synesthesia. Synesthesia seems to go with an unusual degree of cross-activation between what, in most of us, are functionally independent areas of the sensory cortex. Such cross-activation could be based on an anatomical excess of neural connections between different areas of the brain. There is some evidence that such hyperconnectivity is indeed present in primates and other mammals during fetal development and early infancy, but is reduced or pruned within a few weeks or months after birth. There have not been equivalent anatomical studies in human infants, but as Daphne Maurer of McMaster University notes, behavioral observations of infants suggest that the newborn senses are not well differentiated, but are instead intermingled in a synesthetic confusion. Perhaps, as Baron Cohen and Harrison write, We might all be coloured hearing synesthetes until we lose connections between these two areas, somewhere about 3 months of age. In normal development, according to this theory, a synesthetic confusion gives way in a few months, with cortical maturation, to a clearer distinction and segregation of the senses, and this in turn makes possible the proper cross-matching of perceptions, which is needed for the full recognition of an external world and its contents. The sort of cross-matching which ensures that the look, the feel, the taste and the crunch of a Granny Smith apple all go together. In those individuals with synesthesia, it is supposed, a genetic abnormality prevents complete deletion of this early hyperconnectivity, so that a larger or smaller remnant of this persists in adult life. Synesthesia seems to be commoner in children. As early as 1883, the same year that Galton's book was published, the eminent psychologist Stanley Hall described music colour synesthesia in 40% of children interviewed, a figure which may err on the high side. But a variety of more recent studies agree that synesthesia is a good deal commoner in childhood and tends to disappear at adolescence. Whether this goes with hormonal changes or cerebral reorganizations, which are both occurring at this time, or with a movement to more abstract forms of thinking is unclear. While synesthesia usually appears very early in life, there are rare situations which may provoke its appearance later in life. For example, it can occur transiently during temporal lobe seizures or under the influence of hallucinogens. But the only significant cause of permanent acquired synesthesia is blindness. The loss of vision, especially early in life, may lead, paradoxically, to heightened visual imagery and all sorts of intersensory connections and synesthesias. The rapidity with which synesthesia can follow blindness would scarcely allow the formation of new anatomical connections in the brain, and suggests, instead, a release phenomenon, the removal of an inhibition normally imposed by a fully functioning visual system. In this way, synesthesia following blindness would be analogous to the visual hallucinations, Charles Bonnet syndrome, often associated with increasing visual impairment, or the musical hallucinations sometimes associated with increasing deafness. Within weeks of losing his sight, Jacques Lucéron developed a synesthesia so intense as to replace the actual perception of music, thus preventing him from becoming a musician, as he had intended. I had no sooner made a sound on the A string, or D, or G, or C, than I no longer heard it. I looked at it. Tones, chords, melodies, rhythms, each was immediately transformed into pictures, curves, lines, shapes, landscapes, and most of all, colours. At concerts, for me, the orchestra was like a painter. It flooded me with all the colours of the rainbow. If the violin came in by itself, I was suddenly filled with gold and fire, and with red so bright that I could not remember having seen it on any object. When it was the oboe's turn, a clear green ran all through me, so cool that I seemed to feel the breath of night. I saw music too much to be able to speak its language. Complex neurological reactions to blindness, including Lucéron's, are explored further in my 2003 article, The Mind's Eye. Similarly, V.S. Ramachandran, in A Brief Tour of Human Consciousness, described one patient who felt himself invaded by intrusive synesthesia after becoming blind at the age of 40. When his patient touched objects or read Braille, Ramachandran wrote, his mind would conjure up vivid visual images, including flashes of light, pulsating hallucinations, or sometimes the actual shape of the object he was touching. These confusing sensations were often irrelevant and always irrevocable and intrusive, a spurious and distracting nuisance, and greatly interfered with every aspect of life. There is a world of difference, of course, between acquiring a condition later in life and being born with it. For Lucéron, who acquired it in mid-childhood, colour music synesthesia, though beautiful, was intrusive and prevented him from enjoying music. But for those born with colour music synesthesia, it is different. There is a wide range in people's attitudes to congenital synesthesia, the importance it may have for them, and the role it may play in their lives. This is evident even in the small sample of individuals I have described. Michael Torkey, while he has a very strong and specific musical synesthesia, which at one time influenced both his musical sensibilities and his compositions, has come to think over time that it is no big deal. David Caldwell and Patrick Ellen, on the other hand, feel that their synesthesia continues to be central to their musical identity and plays a most active part in their process of composing. But for all of them, synesthesia is natural, almost an extra sense, so much so that such questions as "what is it like?" or "what does it mean to you?" are as unanswerable as asking "what is it like to be alive?" "What is it like to be you?" Part 3. Memory, Movement, and Music. Chapter 15. In the Moment. Music and Amnesia. You are the music while the music lasts. T.S. Eliot, The Four Quartets. In January 1985, his wife records, Clive Waring, an eminent English musician and musicologist in his mid-40s, was reading The Lost Mariner, a piece I had written about a patient with severe amnesia. My patient, Jimmy, I wrote, was isolated in a single moment of being, with a moat or lacuna of forgetting all around him. He is a man without a past or future, stuck in a constantly changing, meaningless moment. Jimmy's story, The Lost Mariner, was published in The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Clive and I, Deborah Waring wrote in her memoir, Forever Today, could not get this story out of our heads and talked about it for days. They had no way of knowing that they were, as Deborah put it, staring into a mirror of our own future. 2 months later, Clive himself was struck by a devastating brain infection, a herpes encephalitis, affecting especially the parts of his brain concerned with memory, and he was left in a state far worse even than that of the patient I had described. Jimmy had a memory span of about half a minute. With Clive, it was only a few seconds. New events and experiences were effaced almost instantly, as Deborah wrote. His ability to perceive what he saw and heard was unimpaired, but he did not seem to be able to retain any impression of anything for more than a blink. Indeed, if he did blink, his eyelids parted to reveal a new scene. The view before the blink was utterly forgotten. Each blink, each glance away and back, brought him an entirely new view. I tried to imagine how it was for him, something akin to a film with bad continuity, the glass half empty, then full, the cigarette suddenly longer, the actor's hair now tousled, now smooth. But this was real life, a room changing in ways that were physically impossible. In addition to this inability to preserve new memories, Clive had a devastating retrograde amnesia, a deletion of virtually his entire past. When he was filmed in 1986 for Jonathan Miller's extraordinary BBC documentary, Prisoner of Consciousness, Clive showed a desperate aloneness, fear, and bewilderment. He was acutely, continually, agonizingly conscious that something bizarre, something terrible, was the matter. His constantly repeated complaint, however, was not of a faulty memory, but of being deprived in some uncanny and terrible way of all experience, deprived of consciousness and life itself. As Deborah wrote, it was as if every waking moment was the first waking moment. Clive was under the constant impression that he had just emerged from unconsciousness, because he had no evidence in his own mind of ever being awake before. I haven't heard anything, seen anything, touched anything, smelled anything, he would say. It's like being dead. Desperate to hold on to something, to gain some purchase, Clive started to keep a journal, first on scraps of paper, then in a notebook. But his journal entries consisted essentially of the statements, "I am awake," or "I am conscious," entered again and again every few minutes. He would write, 2:10 p.m., this time properly awake. 2:14 p.m., this time finally awake. 2:35 p.m., this time completely awake, along with negations of these statements. At 9:40 p.m., I awoke for the first time, despite my previous claims. This in turn was crossed out, followed by, I was fully conscious at 10:35 p.m., and awake for the first time in many, many weeks. This in turn was cancelled out by the next entry. This dreadful journal, almost void of any other content but these passionate assertions and denials, intending to affirm existence and continuity but forever contradicting them, was filled anew each day, and soon mounted to hundreds of almost identical pages. It was a terrifying and poignant testament to Clive's mental state, his lostness, in the years that followed his amnesia, a state that Deborah, in Miller's film, called a never-ending agony. Mr. Thompson, another profoundly amnesic patient I knew, dealt with his abysses of amnesia by fluent confabulations. I originally described Mr. Thompson in A Matter of Identity, a chapter in The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. He was wholly immersed in his quickfire inventions and had no insight into what was happening. So far as he was concerned, there was nothing the matter. He would confidently identify or misidentify me as a friend of his, a customer in his delicatessen, a kosher butcher, another doctor, as a dozen different people in the course of a few minutes. This sort of confabulation was not one of conscious fabrication. It was rather a strategy, a desperate attempt, unconscious and almost automatic, to provide a sort of continuity, a narrative continuity, when memory and thus experience was being snatched away every instant. Though one cannot have direct knowledge of one's own amnesia, there may be ways to infer it, from the expressions on people's faces when one has repeated something half a dozen times, when one looks down at one's coffee cup and finds that it is empty, when one looks at one's diary and sees entries in one's own handwriting. Lacking memory, lacking direct experiential knowledge, amnesiacs have to make hypotheses and inferences, and they usually make plausible ones. They can infer that they have been doing something, been somewhere, even though they cannot recollect what they have been doing or where. Yet Clive, rather than making plausible guesses, always came to the conclusion that he had just been awakened, that he had been dead. This seemed to me a reflection of the almost instantaneous effacement of perception for Clive. Thought itself was almost impossible within this tiny window of time. Indeed, Clive once said to Deborah, "I am completely incapable of thinking." At the beginning of his illness, Clive would sometimes be confounded at the bizarre things he experienced. Deborah wrote of how, coming in one day, she saw him holding something in the palm of one hand, and repeatedly covering and uncovering it with the other hand, as if he were a magician practicing a disappearing trick. He was holding a chocolate. He could feel the chocolate unmoving in his left palm, and yet every time he lifted his hand, he told me it revealed a brand new chocolate. "Look," he said, "it's new." He couldn't take his eyes off it. "It's the same chocolate," I said gently. "No, look, it's changed. It wasn't like that before." He covered and uncovered the chocolate every couple of seconds, lifting and looking. "Look, it's different again. How do they do it?" Within months, Clive's confusion gave way to the agony, the desperation that are so clear in Miller's film. This, in turn, was succeeded by a deep depression, as it came upon him, if only in sudden, intense, and immediately forgotten moments, that his former life was over, that he was incorrigibly disabled, and that the rest of his life would be spent in institutions. As the months passed without any real improvement, The hope of significant recovery became fainter and fainter, and towards the end of 1985, Clive was moved to a room in a chronic psychiatric unit, a room he was to occupy for the next 6.5 years, but which he was never able to recognize as his own. A young psychologist saw Clive for a period of time in 1990 and kept a verbatim record of everything he said, and this caught the grim mood that had taken hold. Clive said at one point, "Can you imagine one night, 5 years long? No dreaming, no waking, no touch, no taste, no smell, no sight, no sound, no hearing, nothing at all. It's like being dead. I came to the conclusion that I was dead. The only times of feeling alive were when Deborah visited him. But the moment she left, he was desperate once again, and by the time she got home, 10 or 15 minutes later, she would find repeated messages from him on her answering machine. Please come and see me, darling. It's been ages since I've seen you. Please fly here at the speed of light." To imagine the future was no more possible for Clive than to remember the past. Both were engulfed by the onslaught of amnesia. Yet, at some level, Clive could not be unaware of the sort of place he was in and the likelihood that the rest of his life, his endless night, would be spent in such a place. But then, 7 years after his illness, after huge efforts made by Deborah, Clive was moved to a small country residence for the brain-injured, much more congenial than a hospital. Here he was one of only a handful of patients and in constant contact with a dedicated staff who treated him as an individual and respected his intelligence and talents. He was taken off most of his heavy tranquilizers and seemed to enjoy his walks around the village and gardens near the home, the spaciousness, the fresh food. For the first 8 or 9 years in this new home, Deborah told me, Clive was calmer and sometimes jolly, a bit more content, but often with angry outbursts still, unpredictable, withdrawn, spending most of his time in his room alone. But gradually, in the last 6 or 7 years, Clive has become more sociable, more talkative. Conversation, though of a scripted sort, has come to fill what had been before empty, solitary, and desperate days.